My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the red back there, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster, taking pictures back here, Hai Wan Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Our technical specialist tonight is the library's technology coordinator, David Renner. Our speaker tonight is a native of Louisville, Kentucky, who grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and Mobile and Cullman, Alabama. And growing up, he said he wanted to alternately be a football player, an artist, and a rock star. But finally coming to his senses, he became interested in history after he had took a course in his freshman year with an especially dynamic professor. At the University of North Alabama, he double majored in music and history before attending graduate school at the University of Kentucky, where he wrote his dissertation on the origins of Jacksonian politics in central Kentucky. After receiving his PhD in 1996, he taught at Kentucky Wesleyan University for 6 years before joining the faculty of the University of North Alabama in Florence in 2002. He's currently researching a number of projects, including a full-length study of Kentucky's Relief War, the influence of Lord Byron's poetry on early America, and the fad of hash eating. And he says it's the kind of hash that makes one high. While revising his dissertation in 2000, he was doing research in the Kentucky State Archives when he came across a box of documents concerning a murder that had been committed in 1825. The box contained testimony from a trial that became known popularly as the Kentucky Tragedy. Much has been written about that murder and trial over the succeeding 150 years by leading literary luminaries. Here to tell us the real story of Kentucky's most celebrated murder, please give a warm welcome to Matthew Schenbacher.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Brian and Peggy and Nancy and everyone at Western for this opportunity, and Barnes & Noble as well. I'm very excited. I made the paper, and my name is spelled correctly, which is a rarity. And it's a very nice review. Thank you, Nancy. Well, all right, with my book, Murder and Madness, what I tried to do first, well, there's two things I've tried to do with this book. The first thing is to basically unravel what happened. This may seem very old-fashioned, and some of my reviewers have told me that it is old-fashioned to try to figure out what happened, that I try to find the facts. We're getting a little too sophisticated in some quarters of the history profession, but try to figure out, to the best of my knowledge, what happened, and try to reconstruct a plausible event, a plausible account of the events of 1825. I then tried to explain why these events resonated well beyond Kentucky. This murder was not just important locally, was not just news locally, but became quite a national sensation, not just here in Kentucky, but throughout the nation, and indeed overseas. But before we proceed, let's try to outline, try to figure out basically what happened. What happened in this story, sometimes it does get a little convoluted, but I'll try my best to unravel it. Basically, this guy, in 1825, 185 years ago, 185 and a half years ago, knocked on this guy's door in the middle of the night in Frankfurt. When the man answered the door, Solomon Sharp answered the door, Jeroboam Beecham stabbed him to death. Before Sharp died before he could regain consciousness, and Beecham ran away. He made it back to Frankfurt, where the authorities came, picked him up, and a day after his arrival, he was brought back. And he, this is in this area. He had, was living down in Simpson County, and had, and Sharp, in fact, had been a lawyer in Bowling Green for a number of years. He'd also been a U.S. congressman from southern Kentucky, and so he is a native of Bowling Green. At the time of his murder, he had moved to Frankfort because his in-laws were there, as well as he was a state assemblyman. Anyway, so he was taken back to Frankfort, and 6 months later, he was put on trial. He denied all the while that he had murdered Solomon Sharp. He said, I am innocent, I am innocent, I'm a victim of political hit job. That is, my political enemies are out to get me. He was put on trial, and after a 2-week trial, he was found guilty. was found guilty in large part because of his own misdoings. He tried to perjure a man. He wrote an entire script for a man to falsely testify. And the man he wanted to falsely testify, get this, was a sheriff. Anyway, he was found guilty and sentenced to hang. He then said, I did it, but I had a good reason. He said, Solomon Sharp was a bad man. He seduced and abandoned the woman I later married. And thus, I killed Sharp to avenge her honor. He then wrote this, so he had 7 weeks in between the trial and his execution. He spent that next 7 weeks, and she helped him. This is one thing that most of the accounts do not cover, but she helped him write this. He wrote this story, this confession, that laid out this very maudlin tale of how this heroic Jeroboam Beecham had killed this villainous Solomon Sharp to avenge the honor of his wife. He hoped to get this account published before his hanging. This did not happen. And on the morning of his execution, they both attempted suicide. Hers succeeded. She managed to kill herself. They stabbed themselves with knives. His did not. And they patched him up long enough to take him outside of town and hang him. It's strange how much people worry about the health of a man who's about to die. But they hanged him. They are buried together in the same grave. They left instructions. Buried in Bloomfield, Kentucky, which is not too far from Frankfort. And there's a tombstone that lays out this very dramatic tale of love and revenge and ultimate tragedy. About 6 months later, the confession was published. Now, they tried to get it published before their execution, but it was published 6 months later and became just a phenomenon. All across the nation, people just were obsessed with this story. And within the next 10, 15, 20 years, this became perhaps the most popular literary motif in early America. Edgar Allan Poe wrote a play based on it. Another very famous novelist today, not so well known, William Gilmore Sims wrote a number of books based on this episode. In our own time, Robert Penn Warren has written a novel in as late as 1950, World Enough in Time, a wonderful, wonderful piece of work. Penn Warren, by the way, did his research, and he was not just a great novelist, but a pretty good historian to boot. But and there have been some histories written as well. But most of these accounts, these literary accounts, these plays, novels, and even up until today, many people take them at their word. That is, that the Beechams were, in fact, avenging honor, and that they were that this man, who was a horrible villain, who was just asking for it. So, what I tried to do is go back and sift through the evidence and try to find out, well, what's going on here. And what you find pretty quickly is that these two guys, the Beechams, Jeroboam Beecham and Anna Beecham, or Anna Cook Beecham, were a very unusual pair, extremely unusual. They were they defied most every convention of early 19th century behavior. She, for example, was quite, let's say, sexually unconventional. She had a number of liaisons. When she was supposedly seduced by bad man here, she was not a young virginal woman who was being abused by this older man. She was 32 years old, and she was very sexually experienced. He, by the way, is 17 years younger than her. There's a generation, almost a full generation difference between these two. But they both were united by this unwillingness to abide by what society said how they should behave. And they were, in fact, a very unusual group. What I tried to do is say they took the basic themes of the literature of their day, crammed their story into it, and the people loved it. The two basic literary motifs of their day came from two sources. First, novels. The novels in the 19th century almost all had very, very similar plots. the seduction novel, as they were known, all told the story of a virginal young woman who was ruined by an evil man. The other major source of literature that they drew upon was Byronic poetry. And they took these two genres, him as the Byronic hero, who will do anything and is brave and daring, and she as the virginal seduced victim, and confected this story, and people just loved it. There were people out there to say, you know what, this is complete BS, this is not true, but people didn't want to hear that. People wanted to hear this story. And I think, by the way, this has something to tell us today, because we love our history a certain way. Reminds me of whenever I tried to teach the story of Columbus and coming to America in 1492, and I tried to tell the students that, no, he did not prove that the earth was round. People knew that. I had been trying to kill this zombie lie for 20 years, and me and historians all across the United States, but we can't do it, because there's something about that story we as America like. This far-seeing, brave man who defies the odds and finds America, yay, the first American. But it's not true. People love their story, even though it was not true. And even though a lot of people, especially around Kentucky, knew it wasn't true. And they tried to tell people, set them straight. This stuff, and then, no, they ran with it anyway. Let me show you some more slides quickly before I talk some more. This, again, this is Solomon Sharp, the victim. He is always portrayed as the villain. If you can read these novels and these plays, this man has the blackest heart who ever lived. He's very often in these novels given names like Wolf and Steel, and he's just a horrible man. In fact, he was quite a good and an accomplished man who not only served in the United States Congress, he was Kentucky's Attorney General, he was a five-time state assemblyman, and was the state attorney general right before he was murdered. He left behind three small children, ages all of them below five, and a wife who was absolutely heartbroken at his murder. She would never remarry, and the day she died, she said, "This portrait is my most precious possession." By the way, I tried to find this portrait. It is now lost. If you ever come across this portrait, please let me know. I actually traced it down to Denver, and apparently his great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter, who has no idea who he was, sold it to a pawn shop or an antique store, perhaps an antique store, I think. And I actually talked to her. I said, "Do you know who this was?" She goes, "No." He goes, "Do you know the story?" She goes, "No." The funny thing is, their family, the Sharp descendants, don't know this story. The Crooks and Beecham descendants know that very well. But the Sharp family doesn't, and because you can see very clearly that with their father, grandfather, great-grandfather being depicted in such horrible terms, they just sort of forgot it. There's a very, very moving story of his son, who was just 2 years old at the time of his murder. He was in Louisville in 1858, and they were putting on one of those plays that depicted his father as this horrible man, and he wrote to the newspaper, Louisville Journal. He said, "Please, this is a lie. This is not true. This did not happen. I have documentation that shows that this is not true and that these guys were liars." The net result, and by the way, he was a very powerful and important man at the time, the net result was they postponed the play for one night. It just, again, see, when people said, "No, this isn't true," people are like, "Oh, yeah, okay, boy, but I like that story." And this is what happens again and again. Some other pictures. This is his house in Frankfurt, in which he was killed. He was a very, very wealthy man, Solomon Sharp. And he, the thief and the murderer went around the side of the house here, knocked on a door, and as he opened the door, stabbed him. This is where he stayed. Beecham stayed the night of the murder. He came all the way from here in Simpson County, stayed. Some people said that it was, Beecham himself said, "I have masterfully planned this murder," and on and on and on. But he did nothing of the sort. This house that he was staying in was owned by the warden of the penitentiary. And he, knowing he was going to commit a murder, hated this guy, snuck out of the house in the middle of the night, and later this provided key evidence in his conviction. This is an example of the literature that shows, that tried to depict what had happened that night. Very little of this is very accurate. This is not how the murder happened, and that he didn't throw him down, start stabbing. It was just quick. And here is a picture, by the way, of the of Frankfurt. And this is where Sharp had lived, and this is where he stayed that night. Beecher stayed that night and walked over there and murdered him. The means, let me say now, the means by which the Beecham got away with his murder. I want to speak about this. I want to read a little excerpt from the book because this suggests where they got the ability to shape the story. And in order to understand why their story had such traction, you have to understand the incredible vogue of Byronic poetry of the day. Now, Lord Byron was the equivalent of a rock star in his day. In fact, sometimes I like to think of it as the first British invasion. The Lord Byron never came to America, but you have to understand he was I think America's first celebrity. He sold more books than any American author. He sold more books than Common Sense. He sold more books almost as much as Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. Byronic poetry was absolutely huge in early America. He never came to America, but it was huge. And not only was it huge, you had a lot of people trying to imitate this style, this character that he had created. So let me read just a little bit from the book where I try to explain what Byron meant to early America and why Beecham was able to tap into this so successfully in creating the myth of the Kentucky tragedy. This literature, the literature of romantic poetry, spoke clearly to all that was wild and rebellious in the early republic. This romantic poetry was a masculine-encoded half of literary subversion. Every bit as popular as novels, romantic verse equally disturbed the powers that were in early America. Jefferson, he had warned earlier, don't read novels. More about that in a moment. At the time, novel reading was very, very suspicious. In fact, in Thomas Jefferson said, "Don't read novels. Your mind will be corrupted." There was one college that debated whether or not novels should be legally prohibited by law. Today, you know, if anyone reads a novel, if my kids read anything, I'm happy. But back then, novels were seen to be very sort of disreputable. Also disreputable was his poetry, so excuse me. The most eccentric and licentious poet of the era was also its most prominent, most accomplished, and most controversial. George Gordon, Lord Byron, the high priest of romanticism. He was the lyricist of his generation, and the youth of America adored him almost from the moment that Philadelphia printer Moses Thompson published Childe Harold's Pilgrimage in 1812. With his American popularity magnified by his opposition to the British cause in the War of 1812, Byron by mid-decade was well on his way to celebrity in the United States. By 1830, 99 American editions of Byron's work had saturated the American market. And 7 years later, when one traveler named Captain Frederick Marriott asked the heads of the great publishing houses of New York and Philadelphia how many copies of Byron's works had been sold, they estimated the number to be somewhere from 150 to 200,000. Such was his influence among Americans that William Prescott insisted that it was Byron, not Sir Walter Scott, who was the representative of the epic. It is difficult now to recapture the singularity of Byron's work, the sheer audacity of an author who did not strive to inculcate any higher virtues in his readers, but rather told of adventures that seemed to positively romanticize deviance. Novels, even if subversive, at least carried a message that traditional morality must be upheld. Byron, on the other hand, dared make a hero of a character who, quote, through sin's long labyrinth had run, a youth who not in virtue's ways did take delight, but spent his days in riot most uncouth. He presumed as well to toy with the ruling opinions of polite and patriotic society, ridiculing the enlightened republicanism of Joseph Addison's Cato that so touched George Washington. And George Washington used to put on this play by Joseph Addison's Cato. And one of the very famous lines of this play, he wanted to inculcate certain ideas and virtue into his troops. And he said, a famous line in this play said, "'Tis not in mortals to command success, but we'll do more, we'll deserve it." That is, be a true virtuous person rather than acting it. Byron mocked the sentiment and cynically turned the meaning inside out. "'Tis not in mortals to command success, but do more, don't deserve it, and take my word, you won't have any less." The idea here, Byron was subversive. And this is where you can make the comparison with rock music. I think it really, you know, you can only take this so far, of course. But Byron was a very, very disturbing figure to many people. And it's one reason why people like Jeroboam Beecham really grabbed on to this figure in this type of literature. Byron himself was, there's even a term for it. They were called Byromaniacs. They created, I think, almost a counterculture of the 1820s. We think counterculture 1960s. But there was a counterculture going on in the 1820s of Byronic poetry and people who tried to scandalize their elders and were quite good at it. He portrayed himself in the confession as this one of these Byronic figures, and they portrayed her as one of these people, seduced heroines, and between them, they basically got away with murder. And weirdly enough, it was posthumous. They did pay, but they won in the end, at least in the eyes of posterity, they won and they did get away with it. And that's why I had called this lecture, and I'd originally called the book To Make Madness Beautiful, because that's what they did. They spun this story in such a way that they won a postmortem victory of sorts. The complete couplet from Byron's Childe Harold's Pilgrimage reads as following, and it's the epigram from my book. "He knew how to make madness beautiful and cast over erring deeds and thoughts a heavenly hue of words like sunbeams, dazzling as they passed the eyes which over them shed tears feelingly and fast." That's, I think, encapsulates pretty much what they managed to get away with. And the truth, although not as fun as some of our stories, I think needs to come to terms with. But also, as I said, I don't want to just set the story straight. I want us to understand why this story resonated so much with the people. And they basically gave their day's literature back to them. And the people were thrilled. Oh, it's true. It really happens in life. And we do it today. We let our stories somewhat dictate what we like to believe. And so maybe in that sense it's a bit of a warning for ourselves. But this is what I try to do in the book. And it's kind of a complicated story, but I think one that bears looking at. So, do you have any questions? Yes.
Do you think the old Newport controversy was at the root of the murder?
Ah, that's a very, very good question. The background to all of this, to this murder, was the old court and new court. And this is a contemporary drawing that depicts or suggests the hatreds and animosities that were unleashed by the politics of the day. Beginning in 1819, there was a terrific political battle over whether or not to pass laws to help people who were in debt. Back then, they didn't have recessions or depressions, they had panics. And people just fell off the edge. There was no food stamps or welfare, and there was no bankruptcy laws. And so if you owed money and couldn't pay, they came, took they put your land up for sale, your farm up for sale, and if it didn't pay the debts, you could still go to jail. It was very, very harsh. And so the legislature, the Kentucky State Legislature, started passing laws to help people who were in debt. Now this gave rise to something called the Relief War. 4 years later, in 1823, the Kentucky courts began deciding that this legislation was unconstitutional. And this just lit a firestorm, and it's known as the old court, new court, because the state legislature decided to outlaw the state Supreme Court, to disband it, and then create a new one more to their liking. It was really an audacious maneuver. It would be as if, you know, like Obama basically abolished the Supreme Court and appointed 9 new justices that he liked. Now, what happens, this murder took place right at the height of this controversy. And basically Beecham, at first when he was denying his guilt, tried to paint it as, hey, I'm old court and the new court people are after me. I'm innocent, but I'm just being caught in this political firestorm. So he tried to get away with that. And a lot of people at the time thought that it was political. In fact, Solomon Sharpe's brother, his name was Leander Sharpe. You can see that his father was very influenced by classical themes. Solomon Sharpe's brother, to the day of his death, thought the murder was at least partly motivated by politics. But that's, I could find no evidence of that. Yeah. Because one of the supposed evidence, one of the supposed clues that it was a political murder was that Beecham had an accomplice that showed him around Frankfurt and showed him where to go murder. But I think if he had an accomplice, he might have said, hey, don't go to the warden's house and spend the night when you murder him. So I see no evidence of an accomplice here. But certainly it's wrapped up. And that's what I was writing on this, that relief war, when I got off on the murder, because it was, that's how I found the murder trial. But it is bound up, but not directly. Yes?
Did she stay in the cell with him?
Yes. She, after he was found guilty, she, at first, when he was taken back, when the posse came and got him down in Simpson County, she stayed behind. She then apparently tried to, remember when I said that he tried to suborn or get that sheriff to suborn himself? Well, apparently she went over to that sheriff and tried to seduce him to sort of prepare the way for this. And but anyway, so he's up there for 6 months and she's down in Simpson County. Halfway through the trial, they're thinking, wait a minute, maybe the wife has something to do with this, Anna Cook, and so they bring her. Once he's found guilty, she goes into jail with him and says, I will go with my husband and I will die with my husband. And she did. And there's a question of why. I say, and I believe, she just didn't have anywhere else to go. She had pretty much, she was so unconventional and she just didn't have anywhere else to go, I don't believe. And she was already 40 years old. And I think that's another reason why they get away with this, because they didn't break character. They were brave enough to follow it to the end. And Anna Cook Beecham is really, I think, an extraordinary figure. I think that she may be the most interesting figure in this entire episode, because she was the one who, I think, shaped this story. It's always called Beecham's confession, Beecham this, Beecham that. And I think she was absolutely crucial to the writing of this confession and how it was created. Now, it is in his handwriting. We have the document. It's at the Filson Club in Louisville. But I think that she, being right there by his side and being so immersed in this literature, she knew. She co-authored it at the very least. So, and she stayed with him and, again, killed herself right before he was hanged.
Thank you.
Yes.
You stated there was she was 17 years his senior.
Yes.
How old were they when they first started to have this affair?
These two?
Yes.
They were married in 1824, but they had been together for a few years before that. So it was about 1821, I think, when they first met. He would have been 18, and she would have been 30, in her early 30s, 18 and 35. 18 and 35 when they first got together. And a lot of people at the time said, you know what, and this is one reason they brought her up to the trial, said, this, she is using him. You know, this is sort of like a Lady Macbeth thing. You know, this is not, he's not, she's the one that's doing all this. Now, he, of course, he denied that and said, no, this is my idea and I forced it on her and this and that. But there is something, it's an unusual pairing. An unusual pairing. Yes?
How did they know
Beecham acted so strangely. It's all the night before the General Assembly meets in November of 1825. And so the very next day, the Assembly was getting together, and all these people would just pour into Frankfurt. It was like one of the great events in the calendar of the early 19th century. And he came into town the night before and then left the first thing in the morning. And people said, wait a minute, why was he here? What was he doing here? And it was the night of the murder. And then someone pointed out that his wife had previously accused Solomon Sharp of a misdeed. And they said, okay, go get him. And that's why. So there was a lot of presumption of guilt. But he denied it all along. He denied it. Said, I did not do it. I did not do it. And only when he was convicted said, oh, yeah, I did, but I had a good reason. It's a little bit. Yes?
You mentioned Beecham's brother. Did Anna Cook Beecham have relatives?
Yes. Anna Cook Beecham, she had, at one time, I want to say she had six brothers. Yeah, and so what had happened, well, when she had originally made an accusation of Sharp back in the day, she had had, and she was here in Bowling Green, and he was living in Bowling Green, she had had five brothers at least living in the neighborhood. She made an accusation against Solomon Sharp, he seduced me, but those five brothers did nothing. Now, that is a key piece of evidence that, as the Sharps later said, she was just a very unconventional woman as far as sexuality goes, and the brothers didn't think she had any honor to defend. Had she in fact been seduced, they would almost have been honor-bound to go hunt down Sharp and kill him. But they did nothing of the kind, and I think that's a huge, the dog that didn't bark, you know, it's something that didn't happen that really should have. And actually, there's another historian who's actually a descendant of her who has made this point, and I think it's a very good point. She was what historians call an unruly woman, and she was very much, she was very, you know, unconventional. And by the standards of her day, however unfair, the brothers didn't think her honor was worth defending.
Can you talk a bit about the trial? There's some famous participants.
The trial, well, yes, there's a number. I think I have some pictures here. The trial took place over 2 weeks. Let's see here. Tell him. This guy was Beecham's attorney. It's John Pope. I don't know if you've heard of John Pope before, but he was an important figure in early Kentucky history. His house has just been renovated in Lexington, or been 15 years ago. It was Latrobe. I think the Latrobe, and it's one of the most beautiful houses in Kentucky. And he was a one-armed man. He lost his arm as a young boy, but he was brilliant. Later became the governor of the Arkansas Territory, was a senator for years and years, a United States senator. And Beecham, when he was first brought to trial, or the grand jury brought in an indictment, he went to person after person, trying to get someone to defend him. But none of the lawyers in Frankfurt were like, you just killed the state attorney general. I'm not going to. He went to this man, John Crittenden. John Crittenden, of course, was later very, very famous as Henry Clay's protege and his successor, who tried to compromise on the eve of the Civil War. He went to Crittenden. He wrote a number of letters to Crittenden, and Crittenden's like, "No, I'm not going to defend you." Finally, he got John Pope to defend him, and so through a 2-week trial, he might get off, but at the very end, or I would say halfway through the trial, that sheriff said, look, Jeroboam Beecham had wrote a script for me. And this script is still in the Kentucky Department of Library and Archives. And you can sit there and read it. I think as printed out, it goes for about 15 pages. And he was supposed to give all this amazingly detailed testimony that would exonerate Beecham. Well, the guy, the sheriff, instead, he said, look, this is what Beecham gave me to try for me to suborn myself. And that really sealed the case. And after that, it was all but a given that he'd be found guilty. And he was found guilty. he was just too clever by half. He really thought he could, it's almost like he believed he could shape reality, and he couldn't. And I can tell you at the end, he did some really crazy stuff with his execution. Yes?
It seems like it would be difficult to, trace all this. Was it really hard?
Yes.
Going through archives? How long did it take to actually...
8 years. So I found the first started on it in 2000. My children are just little things, and now they're in high school. because they're trying to follow these leads, and where they and there's so much misdirection, and the political bias, and when it was very, very difficult. And I don't claim to, this is not, this will hold up forever. No one's ever going to come and say, wait a minute, what about this? But it's the best I could come to as a plausible reconstruction of what happened. And but yeah, it took a little bit of doing. Yes?
If my math is correct, he was 23 when he was
hanged. He was born in 1802, yes, 23. He was 23. And he was brilliant. And this, by the way, some people said, she was using him. But he was not a dummy. He had... back then, there weren't law schools, but he was self-trained, and they put him, and you would just go in front of a judge and ask a bunch of questions, and apparently he just hit it out of the ballpark. The guy was he was very, very smart, and it's a great waste of talent, I think. And he always was subverting things, always trying being countercultural. I mentioned his execution. Bear with me, I won't read much, but he's what he did at his own execution, I think, is fascinating and says so much about who this guy was, Jeroboam Beecham. He was, now keep in mind, on the morning of his execution, his wife had killed himself. He tried to stab himself, but just ended up making a big mess, and was patched up long enough to take to the gallows.
How did they have knives?
That's a good question. They weren't supposed to. She had snuck one. She came in. She had snuck one in. She had snuck a knife. It's more of a shiv, but she had snuck it in. Apparently she, and that they were too much of gentlemen to check.
Not like today.
Okay, he's being hanged. They had to hang him outside of Frankfurt because 5,000, and this is a very big case, over 5,000 people, more than three times the population of Frankfurt, had gathered around the execution grounds. As the wagon bearing Beecham came to a stop in the shadow of the gallows, Beecham complimented its construction. You see, he's trying to be very, he's very, very good gallows, pronouncing it to be a strong one. A veritable core of preachers who had long since arrived surrounded him, inquiring of his state of mind, asking if he was sure he would meet Jesus. Beecham seemed, quote, wholly unmoved, and replied that, quote, his sins were forgiven on Thursday morning. That's another story. He refused to say whether he would commit the crime again, and, tiring of theatrics that were not of his own making, repeatedly and impatiently demanded to be executed. I want to go to my wife. Although the rumor had it that Beecham, like many, many criminals of the day that were about to be executed, would speak to the throng, would speak to the people, would provide those gathered with the thrill of being warned against sinful ways, he refused to do so. So there was almost a script when people were executed back then. You go to the gallows, you stand up, and the preachers say, are you sorry? Like, yes, I'm sorry, I want my soul to go to heaven. And like, good, and you are forgiven. And then they would get up and address the crowd. I did wrong, evil ways, drink led me astray, wrong and long and long. Beecham has none of this. He's not going to have any of this, because he just loves subverting things. He's almost a Byronic hero in his own mind. Anyway, after being lifted up from the Dearborn, the wagon, and stood up, he's been stabbed himself, Beecham asked for a glass of water. Now here's as the runner went for a drink, Beecham turned to the musicians. The musicians there, see, it was like a carnival. It's like... And he asked them, apropos of nothing, to play Bonaparte's Retreat. Now, Bonaparte's Retreat, if you know the song, is not, the kind of music you think would accompany a hanging. Bonaparte's Retreat. It's very lively, real. The puzzled band members were taken aback, and they played the song only after Beecham repeated the request. Historians have struggled to understand Beecham's bizarre choice. One has speculated perhaps the slow version of it was played. Yet the verdict of a local newspaper that the request further demonstrated, quote, the singular cast of mind and feeling of this extraordinary man is much closer to the mark. In one sense, he was obviously juxtaposing his destiny with that icon of romantics everywhere, Napoleon, whom Beecham saw as a fellow genius brought low by overreaching. Jeroboam, like Napoleon in Russia, had gambled and lost, and he too would pay for it. And now, with his Josephine dead, Jeroboam would go out like the world historical figure he was in his own mind. But the request, more fundamentally, was part of Beecham's subversion of his own execution, a means of sabotaging the drama in which he was supposed to star. He understood that a ritual was being enacted and a performance was being staged, but he refused to play a role that he himself had not scripted. This is why he attempted suicide, to deprive the drama of its leading man. Failing that, he waved to the ladies. Oh, by the way, when they're taking him out of, through Frankfurt, he's in the Dearborn, he's waving at the ladies. And there are women hanging out of the windows and crying, oh my God. And see, you can all, they started writing this. Those women wanted to see this, and everyone expected this. He's playing right into the cultural tropes of the day. He admired the construction of his own gallows. He refused to cooperate with the preachers. He would not address the audience. And at the very end, he had a band play a completely inappropriate tune. It was all at once subversive and self-dramatizing, a means of diminishing those around him and magnifying his own Byronic persona. Anyway, the water was brought to him. He drank, and in a firm voice, he announced that he would get to his feet when they were ready. The hangman gave the signal. Beecham rose, and, quote, the rope being fixed, he said, drive off, I am ready to die. The cart started, and at 1:30 he was, and I quote, launched into eternity. So.
Quite an extraordinary talent. On behalf of WKU Library's friends organization, our sponsor, our genial host, Lawrence Snow, we want to thank you for coming out tonight. We'll be arranging to set up some books here if you'd like to buy a copy of this book, and Sharon Redfield will be happy to sign it for you. We hope you'll join us
March 17th.
Come on March 17th in our Faraway Places series from John Aul, the first Western person to scale Mount Everest. We'll be here to talk about that achievement. Then we'll be back here again on April the 7th when noted novelist Janet McMahon will be here to talk about Kentucky women writing the South. So, thanks very much for joining us.